ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci alongside Jason Lank. As always, I want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. Great show for you this week. We're going to be joined by Frank Holm, CEO of U.S. Global Investors. They offer two ETFs, including a gold miners ETF. They're well known for their expertise around gold and precious metals. But interestingly, Frank is also interim chairman of Hive Blockchain Technologies, which is involved in mining cryptocurrencies. And so that puts Frank in a pretty unique position to discuss both gold and cryptos, which is what we'll do today. Frank actually attended the big crypto and blockchain conference Consensus a few weeks ago. So we're going to cover a lot of ground here. We'll discuss Bitcoin's recent price moves. We'll get Frank's thoughts on whether there's any sort of relationship between gold and Bitcoin and talk about which one younger investors prefer. We'll, of course, cover Bitcoin ETFs, and then we'll touch on that gold miners ETF as well. Also on the show this week will be Lance McGray, head of ETF product at Advisors Asset Management. We'll spotlight their suite of high dividend value ETFs. They offer three ETFs in all, led by the AAM S&P 500 High Dividend Value ETF. So we'll do that later in the show. And then to start this week, we'll be joined by ETF.com's Laura Krieger. Jason, we're going to take a bit of a time machine here and travel back a few years. So I remember when we were doing the show back in, 2014, 2015, a topic we could not get away from was currency-hedged ETFs, right? These were all the rage 4 or 5 years ago, but then they sort of faded to the background. You really didn't hear about them as much. But now with everything going on with the trade wars and with the U.S. dollar strengthening over the past year and a half or so, these are starting to get some attention. And so we're going to get back into these with Laura.
It's a great refresher that if you own foreign stocks, you do have a position in that local currency. So you can become an accidental currency trader just by being a foreign stock investor. And we all know currency trading is a tough sledding. There's a lot of different ways to think about that. You can permanently hedge your position all the time and just remove the variable, remove the risk, the volatility associated with currencies. Or, you know, another school of thought is that never hedge. You know, over a business cycle or two, it's going to wash out anyway. I think the difference here is that regardless of what your position is, there will be relative overperformance and underperformance, a tracking error, so to speak, versus what you're not doing. And the challenge will be, can you stick to your plan? You know, that's always the challenge, especially for on the client side. To your point, you know, over the last 5 years ago, you're right. Those funds were front and center. We could not get away from that.
The like dollar every
was,
week.
Every week. And, you know, the dollar was doing well. But, you know, since that period of time, there's been, say, ebb and flow in the flows in and out of the funds. You know, have investors been able to stick with their positions over time as market conditions change. I think that'll be interesting to run by Laura.
All right. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Also, if you enjoy ETF Prime, we would greatly appreciate if you could leave us a quick review on iTunes. Let's chat with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
All right, Laura, so let's flash back to 2015. As we were saying, I don't think anyone could talk ETFs without this topic of currency hedging coming up. It's sort of like, I don't know, what, smart beta or ESG ETFs today. And I found a stat from Bloomberg that assets in currency hedged ETFs peaked at $63 billion in late 2015. And now ETF.com shows these only have about $38 billion. And, you know, I'm not sure if these are classified exactly the same way between Bloomberg and ETF.com, but I think any way you slice it, this space has hemorrhaged assets, which I think is somewhat odd to see when you look at the overall growth of ETFs. So from your perspective, what's happened here? Because if you look at the performance of currency hedged ETFs, it's actually been pretty good overall.
Yeah, exactly. Over the mid and longer term, currency hedged ETFs have done pretty well and outperformed, the non-hedged versions. And so the reason that you're seeing these funds bleeding assets is really the U.S. dollar, right? So when you currency hedge, you are trying to neutralize the moves of foreign currency on your portfolio, on your investments. So you're only exposed to that home currency. And so for U.S. investors, that means when the dollar is rising, you're going to get a bigger bang for your buck if you currency hedge. Between 2014 and 2016, the dollar was rising at a good clip. And so hedged versions of ETFs well outperformed the non-hedged versions. And, you know, you saw tons of performance chasing. We saw this huge influx of money going into these funds, billions and billions of dollars. Like you said, $63 billion at the peak. Then in 2016, late 2016, 2017, the U.S. dollar begins its slide, right, against other currencies. And so when the dollar is falling relative to other currencies, hedging actually makes for worse returns. Basically, you're doubling down on a bad debt or on a bad bet, right? So when there's bad performance, people jumped ship. They jumped ship from these hedged funds to the non-hedged versions. Pulled some numbers in 2017, for example, if you look at the WisdomTree Japan hedged equity ETF, that's DXJ, in 2017, investors pulled about $22 million from that fund versus the previous year where they had plowed in billions and billions, and they put in a net $622 million into the unhedged version of that fund, EWJ, the iShares MSCI Japan ETF. So that's really what's going on. The U.S. dollar is back on the rise again, so you should start to see these currency hedged investments outperform the non-currency hedged ones, and that's what we're in fact seeing. Whether they're going to attract the same level of assets as they did before, that's anybody's guess.
Laura, just taking a step back here, for investors who are new to this space, do you mind briefly explaining how these currency hedged ETFs work? And maybe you can use DXJ as an example.
Oh, sure. So it's fairly simple in practice. The basic idea of a currency hedged ETF is that you have this portfolio of international equities. In DXJ's case, it's Japanese equities. And then there's also a short position in currency futures or forward contracts in that foreign currency. In DXJ's case, it's the Japanese yen. So if the currency ends up falling relative to the dollar, let's say 1%, then the currency hedge position is going to gain 1%. Likewise, if the currency gains 1%, then that hedge is going to lose 1%. And either way, the impact of the currency move is neutralized in the portfolio, leaving only quote unquote, the pure exposure to the underlying stock returns. So I mentioned DXJ, which use as a hedge in the Japanese yen. Another really popular currency hedge ETF is Hedged. That's ticker HEDJ. That holds a currency hedge to the euro. So you can hold, an ETF can hold one currency hedge. It can hold multiple currency hedges at a time. The sky's the limit.
Yeah, and I just to restate what you were saying, I think if you're a U.S.-based investor and you own foreign stocks and that local currency depreciates versus the U.S. dollar, that's a drag on your returns. So with DXJ, if you own Japanese stocks and they rise, let's say, 5%, but the yen falls 5%, your returns are zero. Now, the debate on these, at least for longer-term investors, is whether currency hedging should actually be the default in a portfolio. And on that note, I want to play a quick clip here. We had WisdomTree's Jeremy Schwartz on previously. I would say there aren't five people walking the face of the earth who know more about this topic than Jeremy does. Listen to how he describes this decision.
If you're starting from a blank sheet of paper and you say, all right, I have one strategy that just focuses on the stocks, we call it A. And I have another strategy that just focuses on A plus B, or two sources of risk, which is the stocks plus the currency. Which one really is forced to make two bets? It's pretty clear if you're starting from a blank sheet of paper that A plus B has two bets, right? That the stocks plus the currency is really where you're betting on a currency. When you're doing hedge, you're just focusing on the stocks alone. So you don't get helped when the currency goes up, and you don't get hurt when the currency goes down. And so I think when you think of it from, a complete blank slate, which one really is making a bet on the currencies, you'll see the hedge one is no bet. The unhedged that people have traditionally been using is the one that's really making two bets.
So the point Jeremy is making is if you buy, let's say, European stocks and you don't hedge the currency, you're making two bets, right? One on the local stocks and then another on the local currency. But if you hedge, you're just betting on the local stocks. Laura, do you agree with that view? Because again, there's some debate here.
There is so much debate. The counterpoint, of course, is that currency hedging isn't really useful over the long term. These currency fluctuations are very volatile, but they also tend to revert to the mean, and so you're not going to see a long term benefit from that. That's the counterpoint. But I just tend to come back to the data, right? And what is the data showing? What is the data telling us? And so, recently, I did a story on looking at developed Europe ex-UK ETFs, and I found, quite to my surprise, that basically what I said, currency hedged ETFs have significantly higher returns over a three-year period than non-hedged funds. We're talking 3 to 4 points on average, sometimes even higher, depending on which fund you look at and the strategy in question and so forth. So, yeah, I think there is something to what Jeremy is saying, that currency can and often does make a real impact on international returns that investors often kind of overlook. It can also impact volatility and ETF volatility. So, like I said, currency fluctuations can be volatile. So by hedging them out, you're going to end up with a smoother, more stable ride on the return front. The only thing I will add to this, though, is that hedging can be kind of expensive. Some of these ETFs, the currency hedged ETFs, they on average cost about 45 bips, which is substantially more than some of these core unhedged international ETF costs. So just make sure that if you do kind of investigate a currency hedged option, you're not kind of undoing all of the good that you would be getting by doing currency hedging by paying loss in fees. That's all.
Laura, this is Jason. You hit on something that I was just going to ask you about, and that is the cost of hedging. I think it's important to remember that when these funds take a position in the currency, there's someone on the other side of that trade, and those people need to be compensated for their risk. So that's what you're getting to. Hedging isn't free.
Yep, exactly. Hedging is not free.
But Laura, for investors who are on the fence on this, there is actually another option, which is you can just split the difference, right? You can either own, let's say, half of your allocation in hedged and half in unhedged ETFs. Or as it turns out, there are actually ETFs that will do this for you. For example, there's the Index IQ 50% Hedged FTSE International ETF, ticker HFXI. Do you think an ETF like this might have better longer-term potential in terms of investor interest just because you don't have to make that currency decision?
Yeah, So I think HXFI is kind of an interesting case. I think it depends on what benchmark you're comparing it to, right? Like you're hedging the hedge. If you look at it compared to an unhedged fund, the you know with the U.S. dollar strengthening and everything, it has done better than some of the unhedged funds of the past 3 years. It has underperformed currency hedged versions, though, right? So, you know, I think since you're hedging the hedge, you're never going to be able to ride that train fully, whether the train is the dollar strengthening or the dollar falling. You're always going to be lagging something, and that can be a bit challenging for investors psychologically to constantly be looking at where the grass is greener. The other thing, though, about you know hedging 50% is that it can lead to a lower volatility overall than you know the currency hedge version or the non-currency hedge version. You're smoothing out your risk with that 50% hedge. And there are plenty of investors for whom that makes a lot of sense, and that is, alone is going to help them stick to their investment portfolio and their investment choices. So, you know, it's really kind of up to the investor, the individual investor, and what their risk tolerance is.
Yeah, and by the way, we've been talking stocks today. We should mention there are also currency-hedged bond ETFs. As a matter of fact, the largest currency-hedged ETF out there is the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF, ticker BNDX. I don't think some investors realize that's hedged. Laura, we have just a couple of minutes left. What about actual currency ETFs? Do you think those could be a viable option for investors who are concerned about currency moves?
Well, so currency ETFs, they're interesting. They just hold currency futures, which is very different than a portfolio of stocks that is currency hedged. So as far as I understand it, historically, these ETFs have been used to implement a currency future. So you know, one of the great things about ETFs is that you can short them. So you could short a euro currency ETF and hold a euro stocks ETF and then effectively get that currency hedge for cheaper than you could, you know, just buying a currency futures or, you know, and trying to do it yourself. You know, as more products have come onto the market, that has become less feasible an option to do on your own, and especially since these currency ETFs tend to have high fees, like we were saying before, you know, you tend to get killed in the fees with currency ETFs, and so the strategy doesn't really make as much sense as maybe it used to now that international ETFs hedged and not hedged have come down in price. And I think investors have started to sort of realize that. They pulled a lot of money out of currency ETFs. There's only $1.5 billion invested in the space, over 20 ETFs. And most of that is in dollar ETFs, which are, you know, tracking the moves in the U.S. dollar. It's not even foreign currency related. So you'll never hear me badmouth an ETF, but I would certainly, you know, Use your best judgment with these ETFs,
always,
whether they make sense for you.
Always good advice. Laura, I'm going to leave you with some quick ETF trivia with Mexico in the news with the trade wars. Did you know there is actually a currency hedge Mexico ETF? So iShares has the currency hedge MSCI Mexico ETF, ticker HEWW. I did not know that. Now, it hardly has any assets. And I believe there was actually an Xtrackers product, but that closed up shop. But perhaps this will gain some interest with Mexico now in the trade war crosshairs. Laura, always appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. When we come back from break, we're going to visit with Frank Holm, CEO of U.S. Global Investors. This should be a fun conversation. We're going to talk Bitcoin, gold, and also look at their gold miners ETF. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci alongside Jason Lank. And now joining us via phone from San Antonio is Frank Holm, CEO of U.S. Global Investors. They offer a couple of ETFs, including a gold miners ETF. Frank is also interim chairman of Hive Blockchain Technologies, which owns cryptocurrency mining facilities. So Frank is Obviously, very uniquely positioned to talk both gold and cryptos, which is what we'll be focusing on today. Frank, always a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts.
So, Frank, let's start with cryptos. As I mentioned, you are involved with Hive Blockchain Technologies. I know you attended the big crypto and blockchain conference in May, Consensus. How did you first get involved in the crypto space?
I was trying to launch an ETF, and I quickly found out that the great concerns of the SEC was AML, anti-money laundering concerns, and that some of these coins could have come from Russians or Chinese hackers, etc. So there's no way they want to have a tainted coin showing up in a listed New York Stock Exchange ETF. So I went to Canada and got the same pushback of the AML concerns, and I had all this sort of knowledge going nowhere, and friends of mine approached me that there was this opportunity to take the first industrial scale company public, and would I go on as a seed shareholder? And I did. So I put money into that rather than trying to battle the regulatory legal costs, which I think are just going to continue to be long drawn out, and got into mining Ethereum and then Bitcoin. And so when we validate a transaction, we mine virgin coins. So they're not tainted. They're brand new and they're of higher demand because of this clean coin.
Okay, so anyone who's been following Bitcoin over the past couple of years knows it's been a wild ride. Bitcoin climbed all the way up to nearly 20,000 in December 2017, then fell 80-plus percent to around 3,200 in December of 2018. But now it's one of the top-performing assets this year. It's up like 120%. Give us your take on Bitcoin's price moves over the past couple of years. Do you think there are any real drivers here, or is the market still trying to make heads or tails of exactly what Bitcoin is?
Well, it's an incredible piece of speculation and is capturing its own followers as an asset class. I think that that's what's really important, that you're even having institutions, endowment funds buying, even putting 50 basis points to 1% into their funds. But it's still speculation. And I think it's really quite remarkable when we take a look at that Bitcoin peaked with the creation of the futures market, which was basically a way that a lot of people believed that it was to suppress Bitcoin. And we had nothing but a negative news all along until this year in February when J.P. Morgan came out with their own cryptocurrency, a stable coin backed by the dollar, and that was the bottom. And then the CME talked about getting rid of their futures contracts because there was not that much interest in them. So I think it's just, you know, it's an early, early stage, a new asset class, a new form of transporting money. It has lots of regulatory hurdles to get through. But what's important for listeners is the daily volatility that is 70% of the time, one standard deviation of the S&P 500 is about 1%. It's the same for bullion, but Bitcoin is 5%. So it's five times the daily volatility. So any type of an uptick like we've seen, it just moves much greater than the overall S&P. In sort of a unique asset class for portfolio diversification.
So, Frank, on that note, as someone who's involved in both cryptos and gold, because, again, your firm, U.S. Global, does have a long history in the gold market, I'm really curious to get your thoughts on Bitcoin versus gold and sort of the interplay between these two. Do you view Bitcoin as a gold alternative? And I guess, if not, how should it be viewed?
No, I don't think it's an alternative. I think down the road it could be like Andy Warhol's original Mao screen paintings that came out at $1,000 and now go for $250,000. Bitcoin's capped at 21 million coins. And it's eventually going to become almost like a collector's item as more people want to have even one coin. And you get a fraction of a coin, but having an original virgin coin over time is going to be like collecting art. The way I look at it, you can't wear Bitcoin. Interesting enough, Bitcoin needs to have a gold look to it. It's a coin that looks like gold to give its credibility. And you need electricity for it to work. When you have a crisis like you had in Vietnam of both people getting out, it was gold, 24 karat gold that got them out. They didn't have electricity on those boats. So one has to really take a look at gold's historical significance. And what's also really important, that 60% of the demand for gold is love. It's about jewelry demand. And it's about something that's, that you can pass on to your family for generations, like they have in India. Like India has six times, the women in India wear six times the amount of gold that's in Fort Knox. That's how they protect themselves over centuries from bad government decisions, and at the same time they wear their wealth. So Bitcoin can't do that. But Bitcoin can facilitate in the new economy, the new digital world. And I think that that's was the thing that really excited me, the whole idea, even quant trading, the idea of the cloud and how it allows you to look at data so differently and movement of funds and flows, et cetera. And especially when you have Ethereum, the second biggest coin, which is a smart contract, which is a new stock exchange has come out all based on the Ethereum protocol. So I think there's lots of new growth opportunities in this space. And I try to remind people, if you remember Ask Jeeves, I mean, what happened to Ask Jeeves? And then Yahoo, and all of a sudden the survivor's Google. I don't know who's going to survive in this race, but the digital world and new securities coins, it's all coming on the backbone of the success of Bitcoin.
Frank, this is Jason Lank. You mentioned the term location. My understanding is you have operations in Iceland and Sweden. For those not familiar with the details of the mining process, why would you locate mining facilities there?
Green energy. It's clean energy. It's very inexpensive. Now we're finding places in the U.S. To expand where you're getting solar energy, and it's more consistent, and wind energy. So wherever there's renewable energy is where we want to go. We do not want to be where it's coal. We want to be where it's clean energy and also inexpensive energy. The only way you survive in this game is to have cheap electricity.
Frank, going back to the Bitcoin versus gold debate, this is completely anecdotal, but when I talk to younger investors and this topic of Bitcoin versus gold comes up, I've got to tell you, the overwhelming majority of younger investors prefer Bitcoin. That seems to really be where their interest lies. Do you think that could ultimately become a problem for gold down the road, just as money shifts to younger investors? Could that negatively impact gold demand in any way?
I will lay odds as gender bias data. That's predominantly men. Women are going to take the gold. and if you have a gold-plated or 24-karat Bitcoin going, then they'll take that. No, I think that the idea of gold as a monetary asset, it's the fourth most liquid asset class in the world. And interesting enough, 60% of the demand is not central bankers and quarters. It is jewelry. And I don't think Bitcoin is going to replace that. But I think what happens is that a lot of young men and boys have been playing video games and then now mobile games, et cetera. And there's rewards mechanisms, there's digital money. It's almost like my gender that we used to collect miles for flying. There was a way that was our digital way of being able to upgrade with our miles points, et cetera. And I think that world, the young world, is very caught up with the new experience of digital world, like Tinder. Like the idea that you would trust that person is representing who they are. Uber, it took me a while to trust Uber. It took me longer to trust Airbnb, which is now the biggest hoteler in the world without any hotels. So that new digital world is showing up in our space in quant funds. 70% of the daily trading in the stock market are quant funds. So I think that's really important is that young person you're talking to is a digital world. And I think that the cryptocurrencies and crypto securities are down the road. They're definitely going to relate to it.
All right. Before we move on here, you mentioned Bitcoin ETF at the top and the anti-money laundering concerns that perhaps the SEC had. Do you think the SEC should approve a Bitcoin or crypto ETF?
I think the easiest way to do it was to say that only virgin coins mined in North America could be able to go into an ETF. That way they know there's no tainting on them. And what that would do is that would automatically bifurcate the global Bitcoin prices. So coins coming from China, Russia, would automatically go second tier. They'd have to find another space. And it's just like the U.S. dollar is the superior dollar. You could create the superior Bitcoin by doing it this way. That's been my proposal that's on the table, and I hope it connects through. But coming back in this digital world, it's just really, you know, it's interesting to see how it has so many ramifications in every part of our life. I was blown away by a guy, Game Layden, who I met last summer in this sort of crypto space. And he created Machine Zone, which is mobile games. And I was just really shocked when, you know, you see the cape up in the commercials for the Super Bowl. Underneath all of that, he's processing 500 million instructions per second in 32 languages for kids to play all over the world, and has done $6 billion in revenue. They need these data centers like we have in Iceland, and I found out that our small data center in Iceland could process 100 million instructions per second. So the longevity of us mining Ethereum all of a sudden means that we could be coming, using our GPU chips, we could be creating a smart city. Where cameras are put everywhere to protect citizens. Bad people that have not paid their parking tickets could automatically be picked up with these new cameras. So it's interesting to see how it's growing rapidly. The use of the cloud, you need cheap electricity, you need renewable energy, and you need GPU chips.
Frank, your comment on knowing where the Bitcoin are mined and maybe only coins mined in North America being in an ETF, is it possible to track that?
Oh, yes. It's an open ledger. There's new technology out there that the law enforcement uses, the DOJ, the FBI, et cetera. I know they do it in Canada, too. And I know the banks that where we sell through always go and check our coins. And so they can see if a coin came from the dark net immediately. Those coins get quarantined. Segregated immediately. That's what the banks tell me, and that's what some of these service providers tell me. They're in this space of creating sort of an AML screen for these coins.
Our guest is Frank Holmes, CEO of U.S. Global Investors. Frank, we have a few minutes left. As I mentioned, U.S. Global does have a long history in the gold market, and you currently offer a gold miners ETF that I wanted to ask you about, the U.S. Global Go Gold and Precious Metal Miners ETF, ticker symbol GOAU. Can you tell us a little bit about what this ETF holds?
You know, what I saw in that digital world is how could I use a quant approach to picking gold stocks. And fund flows were different than the paradigm of the old gold analysts of looking at factors like NAVs, the price to book values, et cetera. It's antiquated. And most of the fund flows today are quant driven. So I noticed that the F factor, the Prokowski F factor, the Stanford professor, where they do a lot of income analysis, ratios on the income statement, they're much more predictive of where gold stocks are being picked and liquidity and where they'll go, and then sentiment analysis. So with that, I created this ETF, and I always knew that the royalty companies, which are a very superior business model, I was blessed to be able, as a young analyst, to be able to take a company public called Franco Nevada, which is the largest royalty company in the world. They have revenue of $21 million per employee. Goldman Sachs is $1 million. And it's a very stable cash flow. And there's Wheaton, so it used to be called Silver Wheaton, and Wheaton Resources. And then you have gold. The other one is Royalty Gold Royalty. You have these companies, and they enjoy huge returns on capital. So they're 30% of the portfolio, three biggest names. They're 10% each, they rebalance each quarter. And then the model was to look at these other factors that drive sustainable performance. And what we noticed is a lot of these companies had made the acquisitions, financings, and it was very dilutive on the key financial factors on a per-share basis. So we modeled it for 25 other names, 80% are North American, 20% foreign. It scales down to $200 million market cap. And what it's done is the back testing said it would outperform, going back over 12 years, the GDXJ 92% of the time. So we felt confident in launching this product. And so we launched it, GOAU, Go Gold, on the New York Stock Exchange, and has done that. It's outperformed the GDXJ by a wide margin since we launched it 2 years ago. I think it's outperformed by 13%. So it's done exactly what the model said it would do. And hopefully, you know, past performance don't guarantee a future results, that it can maintain that selectivity rather than just market cap. We found that just buying big liquid market cap names in gold stocks is a losing proposition over time.
Frank, any quick thoughts on the current gold market? You know, gold had essentially been flat this year, but it shot up here recently. What's your take on gold?
Well, I think you've always advocated the golden rule, that is the 10% allocation of gold. When you look at Ray Dalio, Ray Dalio is the biggest hedge fund in the world. He's always has a position of gold against other countries' currencies and trades in and out around them. And if you look at data points, I think Morgan Stanley had a published report that over the past 20 years, the best asset class has been REITs. Second is gold. It's really shocking for a lot of people that gold would be such a great asset class. And the royalty companies have far outperformed the overall average gold stock. And so I think that you should have at least 10%. You can go up to a higher percent. But the magic, because of the volatilities when it comes to gold stocks, is to rebalance each quarter. If you give you an idea, the daily volatility of the S&P 500 and gold are about 1%, but gold stocks are 3%. So you've got to, when you get these runs, you have to be able to capture them and then recalibrate your portfolio. And that's what guys like Ray Dalio with Bridgewater do. So you can do it in the sort of modern portfolio theory of recalibrating on a regular basis.
Well, Frank, we're going to have to leave it there. Always appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us.
Well, happy investing.
Thank you. That was Frank Holmes, CEO of U.S. Global Investors. And you can learn more about the gold miners ETF we discussed by visiting usglobaletfs.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll spotlight a suite of high dividend value ETFs. We'll be joined by Lance McRae, head of ETF product at Advisors Asset Management. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Now it's time for our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
The ETF we're spotlighting this week is the AAM S&P 500 High Dividend Value ETF. The ticker symbol is SPDV. And now on the line with us from New York is Lance McRae, head of ETFs at Advisors Asset Management. Lance, thanks for joining us this week.
Hey, good morning, Nate. Thanks for having me on the show this morning.
So, Lance, AAM is a relative newcomer to the ETF space. Your first ETF was launched towards the end of 2017. I know another one was launched at the end of last year. There are three ETFs in all. Before we talk about SPDV, can you give us some background on the firm and why you got involved in ETFs?
Sure. So this year, 2019, is actually a very big year for Advisors Asset Management, or as we're known, AAM. This year is our 40th year in business. You know, we have 250 professionals. We have, close to $25 billion in assets under management and supervision. But clearly, with a 40-year track record, as you noted, we just got into the ETF business. But historically, we've really been, we got into the industry as a, more on the broker-dealer side, on the bond broker-dealer side, where we really service advisors with their individual bond portfolios. But recently, in the last 10 years, we've very, successfully rolled out an asset management arm. We currently are a major player in the unit investment trust space. We have a very, a thriving SMA business, which has a substantial amount of assets tied to it. We have a handful of mutual funds with nearly $1.5 billion in assets in those. And now, as you mentioned, we're getting into the ETF space. So while we are a newcomer in the ETF space, we've certainly, we've been around and we certainly are a player in the asset management world.
So let's walk through the AAM S&P 500 High Dividend Value ETF. This falls into the quote-unquote smart beta ETF category. Take us through the investment process here.
Okay, so really, in a nutshell, what this strategy is doing is really looking to combine two of the major ways that people or investors really tap into the benefits of dividends. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, for the last 20 or 30 years, people really fall into two camps. One is looking at or holding the highest dividend-paying stocks because they tend to outperform. And on a side note, they also offer the income that the investors, you know, have really looked for in this low-rate environment. On the flip side, another way to tap the benefits of dividends is really to focus on dividend payers or dividend growers, where you're not looking to maximize your dividend yield, but what you're trying to do is find stable companies that have, you know, solid fundamentals and are able to grow those dividends over time. So you're looking for the compounding of those dividends. But what we're doing in these products, and it's really, you know, we're taking the stance that it doesn't have to be either or, right? These don't have to be mutually exclusive strategies. So what we've done with the help of S&P is we've created this strategy, our high dividend value suite, which really looks to tap the benefits of both of those dividend camps. So what we do is we start with a starting universe. In the instance of SPDV, we start with all of the securities in the S&P 500, and we really look at two fundamental metrics. The first is dividend yield, as you can imagine, but the second, to look at the dividend sustainability of a company, is we look at free cash flow yield. And this is really the key component, and this is really what separates our funds or our dividend products from other products out there, is that we are the only ETF provider out there that treats high yield and dividend sustainability equally. So each security in the portfolio or in the starting universe, we look at every security. Each security is rated from essentially 0 to 1 on both the dividend yield front and also the dividend sustainability front, which is looked at through free cash flow yield. And we take 5 securities from each GIC sector. So there's 11 GIC sectors. We take 5 securities from each that have the best combination of those two. So the highest free cash flow yield and the highest dividend. We equal weight those. So you get a portfolio of 55 securities. All are equally weighted. So you get the sector diversification. And you're in securities that not only have a high dividend yield, but also have, you know, a high free cash flow to maintain and potentially grow that dividend over time.
And Lance, with that free cash flow yield screen, is the idea here really just to steer clear of so-called value traps?
Exactly. As you know, one of the major issues with focusing on high dividend paying stocks is that, you know, a dividend yield could be going up for the wrong reasons. And what we're trying to do here is avoid the companies that are essentially, you know, not fundamentally strong. If there's bad news and the stock, you know, stock price plummets, that essentially is raising the yield. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So by looking at, you know, free cash flow, it balances it off very, very nicely. So every 6 months when we do rebalance the portfolio, and again, it's 100% rules-based, and it's always rebalanced every 6 months, you know, you're always in 55 securities that have a very high dividend yield and are offering the free cash flow. So, yes, to your point, by looking at the free cash flow, yes, that is a major way that we look to avoid, you know, catching the falling knife or looking or trying to avoid the companies that have an increasing yield because of the wrong reasons.
Does the incorporation of that free cash flow yield as a screen impact the overall dividend yield at all? Is the dividend profile of the ETF lower because of that screen?
Well, that's a very good question, and we do get that frequently. And you know, I offer to everybody on the listening, we have a fantastic white paper that S&P produced that really talks about, you know, the underlying index methodology and the benefits. And one of the conclusions that we came up with when we did this analysis is that by choosing a portfolio that's sort of focusing on high dividend yield and high free cash flow securities, you know, we historically have seen higher risk adjusted returns than both a pure dividend yield and a pure free cash flow yield portfolio without sacrificing much on the yield front. So right now, I think we'd be essentially be giving up about 30 or between 20 and 40 basis points in yield, which when you think about it, you know, really isn't that much to potentially avoid companies that may potentially cut or eliminate their dividend in the future.
You know, one of the things I'm curious about is the role of stock buybacks. So instead of paying cash dividends, we know a growing number of companies have instead bought back their own stocks. This is a more tax-efficient way to get capital back into shareholders' hands. How has that impacted your screens and investment process, if at all?
Well, in terms of the impact of our index methodology and the strategy itself of SPDV, it really doesn't impact it from an index methodology. As I alluded to, our products are 100% passive. They're all rules-based, and they do exactly what the index methodology states. But to your point, yes, we are seeing, like dividends, right, buybacks are efficient means to return excess cash to shareholders. And one of the byproducts of our strategy, while we certainly aren't looking for companies that are buying back stock, because in reality what we're looking to is maximize our dividend yield without sacrificing dividend sustainability, it's also important to understand, though, if a company has a high free cash flow, right, they can do a number of things, right? They can obviously, you know, maintain the dividend and grow the dividend, which we're looking to capture, but they can also pay off debt. They can buy back stock, or even they can expand the business. So while we're not necessarily looking for companies that that necessarily buy back stock per se, we are attracting companies that have high free cash flow. And with that said, you know, buybacks tend to be a sort of a byproduct of our index methodology.
Lance, this is Jason Lank. According to the methodology, you picked the five top-ranked stocks in each of the GIC categories. But, of course, in one category, the sixth-ranked stock might be more attractive than the fourth in a different category. Are you willing to potentially give up maybe some upside in order to maintain that diversification?
No question. And that is another major differentiator from our products. When we set out and created this dividend suite, there was we did a massive look back of all the dividend products out there, not only in ETFs but in active strategies and mutual funds as well. And what we've realized is that more so than not, people are impacted negatively by the lack of diversification in dividend paying ETFs or funds, because in most instances, they're reaching for yield. So they're going to be in the sectors that tend to outperform, but have high dividend yields. Some of the largest dividend ETFs out there right now have north of 25 or 30% allocated to individual sectors just because they're the highest yielding sectors. So what we really wanted to do is, giving our, fairly concentrated portfolio of 55 names is one of the ways that we diversify our product line. Our strategy is to diversify across sectors. And by selecting five from each sector, we offer, potentially 55 securities that offer high yield and high free cash flow. And that's a major talking point for us. Look at yesterday. What happened to yesterday with the technology stocks? Having that sector diversification as we did helped us outperform by, 120 basis points over many of our peers yesterday. So, yes, that is, while in some instances, for, say, the last 6 months or so when technology has really run, our underperformance can be really attributed to, our underweighting in technology. But we really see that in the long run as a benefit, as a key differentiator from our product versus others. So, yes.
Lance, we only have about a minute left, but on this topic, you were talking earlier about the different things that companies can do with their cash. And as I'm sure you're aware, there are some other ETFs out there that look at shareholder yield, right? Stock buybacks, mm-hmm. dividends, and paying down debt. Mm-hmm. What are some of the similarities and differences between those ETFs and SPDV?
Yeah, so when we structured SPDV, my background, I initially started off in the hedge fund space, the $3 billion hedge fund, relative value strategies, and macro strategies. And one of the things that I realized, as I worked there, to start my career is we have a tendency of making things complicated. And what we've done with this entire suite is really to make things as simple as possible. And what we're trying to do, and to what I alluded to earlier, is to maximize our dividend yield and maintain that sustainability. And one of the easiest ways to look at sustainability is with free cash flow, right? And so we're not trying to overcomplicate the things. If a company, and it's basically common sense, if a company is generating positive free cash flow, the likelihood of them being able to maintain their dividend going forward is positive. And that's, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do. So I think it comes down to simplicity. Those strategies, like ours, are very similar, but we really try to make it as simple as possible instead of making it complicated.
Well, Lance, we're going to have to leave it there. Excellent spotlight today. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
That was Lance McGray, head of ETFs at Advisors Asset Management. And you can learn more about their suite of high dividend value ETFs by visiting AAMLive.com. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit LeggMason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Next week, Jordan Ferris, head of ETF product development at Nuveen, will talk ESG investing, and we'll look at Nuveen's ESG ETF lineup. And then Eric Urban, CEO of Blockforce Capital and Reality Shares, will discuss blockchain ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.